All right, welcome everybody. It's good to have you at Elaine's. My name is Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife Cynthia's in my restaurant. We are Alexandria cuisine, so it's Middle Eastern with French and Greek influences based on her family recipes. It's really nice to have you here. We've turned it into a literary salon. This is the 123rd interview we've done, and wow. One of my favorites, by the way. I'm a big fan of yours, Jeff.
Thank you.
Oh my God, this guy's got so many bestsellers, it's ridiculous. You're putting the rest of us to shame. So if you and I know we have a couple writers in here and maybe some wannabe writers, if you are, feel free to use the literary salon. People come in here all the time for advice, and we have writers groups and book clubs and everything in here. So it's really nice to have you. I'm excited today to have John Gilstrap with us. John is the New York Times bestselling author of Total Mayhem, Scorpion Strike, Final Target, Friendly Fire, Against All Enemies, Endgame, High Treason, Damage Control.
Dear God. Okay.
Threat Warning, Hostage Zero, No Mercy, Nathan's Run at All Costs, Even Steven, Scott Free, and 6 Minutes of Freedom. That is just amazing. In addition, John has written 4 screenplays for Hollywood, adapting the works of Nelson DeMille, Norman MacLean, and Thomas Harris. He's contracted to write and co-produce the film adaptation of his book, 6 Minutes to Freedom. A frequent speaker at literary events, John also teaches seminars on suspense writing techniques at a wide variety of venues, from local libraries to the Smithsonian Institution. Outside of his writing life, John is a renowned safety expert with extensive knowledge of explosives, hazardous materials, and fire behavior. John lives in West Virginia, so please welcome John Gilstrap.
I kind of want to end it there.
Thank you all for coming. Drive safely, don't forget to take your service. So, John, that is quite an impressive resume. First off, I'd like to say just personally, we've been on a panel together recently, but you're the most generous author with your time and your advice with other authors. And it's one of the things in the writing community where, and I don't know if you, this will be in the form of a question. Do you, I've noticed that thriller, mystery, suspense writers are some of the most generous writers here. And my staff has noticed that too, because we do all genres here. Have you noticed that, or is that just us?
I think that's true. You know, when I first started, there wasn't an internet that was accessible by real people. And I had finished Nathan's Run, didn't know what to do with it. So back then I called Stephen Hunter, who was then the film critic for the Baltimore Sun. And through a connection through Rotary, and he answered his phone. He was very helpful. And I said, can I ask you for some favors? And he said, please God, don't ask me to read your manuscript. And I said, no, I wouldn't do that. But, you know, he gave me his agent's name and he talked me through the whole process. And he was, so yes, I think that's an ongoing thing. Nobody succeeds in the entertainment business, any quarter in the entertainment business.
So, you know, that's true. But then Hollywood's known to be pretty cutthroat, right? So why is it that mystery thriller writers are so helpful to others? Is it because it's genre and they're readers first?
Well, I think it's because when you write, Tom Young is over here, he writes. We write different things. You can't hurt my career, right? It's not a zero sum.
Well, wait till this interview comes out.
But it's not a, we're not vying to get the same role, right? We're trying to tell stories in our own way. And frankly, if you tell a story really well and in the acknowledgments or whatever, you say nice things about the authors who were there that who helped you, who that your reader had never read before, then, you know, you sort of expand. This is the opposite of a zero-sum line of work.
And that's probably true for a lot of other genres, too. Yeah, it seems like these are the most collegial in some ways.
Have you been to a romance writers conference?
I have not.
Oh, my goodness. That was more drunk folks per square foot at romance writers than I've ever seen anywhere else. Plus half naked men with long hair with the models from the book covers.
I thought you were confessing something.
No,
you got to the long hair part.
No,
we're both safe. That's
right. You can tell them all.
So we're here to talk about Burn Bridges, which is the first in your series. The Irene River is a brand new thriller series. Super excited about it. Do you want to just give us a little synopsis, a little back jacket copy? What's the book about?
So Burn Bridges features Irene Rivers, who was the FBI director through so far 17 of the. Come on in. It's a martini. Just bring it on in. Thank you. I'll be so much more intelligent right at the bottom of that glass. Irene Rivers was the FBI director through the Jonathan Gray series, and in Zero Sum, which was the most recent of those books, she tanks the presidential administration, and she loses her job, and she's persona non grata in Washington, so she moves to West Virginia to family land just to be done. And, you know, she's a mom of teenagers, but she's not really been a mom of teenagers because she's been important. She's trying to learn to do things like cook. And but what really drives the story is her, one of her kids, her nephew actually, custodial nephew, finds a body on their property, stuffed in a cave, which I live in West Virginia as well. And they have a lot of these limestone, some people call them sinkholes, some call them caves. Some you drop a rock down, you swear to God, it just never hits the bottom. And true story, where the story comes from, I was walking my dog. I have a dog named Kimber. She's 23 pounds of loveliness. And she wanted to go down into one of these caves because she thinks she's tough. And I was pulling back. I said, there is nothing down there that you want to meet.
That goes for both of you.
Exactly. Anything that lives down there is tougher than you are. And I thought, wow, what a cool idea to have a dog pull out something out of the cave. And it's on Irene Rivers' property, a lady who's trying to disappear. And now there's a body on her property. It's been there for a long time. And this is a community that has secrets to hide. And this is part of the secrets that are being hidden. And then it goes from there. So Irene is, thank you. I don't know what this looks like. There's only a hand that comes in.
it could be anything. We're thriller writers here.
So in essence, she is no longer a private person. She's public, and she's discovering that corruption isn't just in big cities like Washington. Corruption is also in small towns in Jenkins County, West Virginia, which doesn't really exist, but it looks a lot like the area where I live.
So this is in the universe,
yes.
But a new series. What was the reason for jumping to like a new protagonist and starting a new related series?
Well, so Irene started in 1998 in my second book, At All Costs. She was a field FBI agent who accidentally let the people at the top of the most wanted list get away. She had them in custody, didn't know who they were. They got away, and that kind of what drives that book, At All Costs. And I didn't intend for her to be a big character. She kind of evolved a bigger character in that story, and then we move on. 10 years later, I'm writing No Mercy, which is the first book of the Jonathan Graves series, and I need to have a director of the FBI. But, well, why not have Irene Rivers be the director of the FBI for a walk-on scene? And again, over 17 books in that series, she evolved. And that storyline over 17 books finally had to come to an end. And that left her unemployed, and I thought, she's too good a character. So I gave her a new series.
So loyalty to the character made you
yes.
to bring her in.
Yes, kind of. And she's named after I never met my wife's mother. She died about 2 weeks before the blind date when I met Joy. And so when I named the character originally, it was an homage to her mom. And I don't know, it's kind of keeps going. And,
my wife recently told me not to name characters after anybody she knows because things keep coming true in the book that I'm writing.
That's disturbing.
Yes, it really is. So I've talked to a lot of authors who write long series, and they tend to get some burnout, but you have the affection for the characters as well, and you're writing in a universe, right? So sometimes, in some ways, it's easier, in some ways it's harder. So did you start feeling some of that burnout after 17 books?
No, I worry that there's... I write a product, right? And it's driven by the popularity of the product. So I get concerned that maybe the audience might shift, and I like this world. So I really wanted to do a different kind of thriller. The Jonathan Graves books are the world is in jeopardy. It's like the stakes are always huge. I want to do smaller stakes. Equally important, but getting back to kind of my roots I do thrillers about families, mm-hmm. and that's kind of where my roots are, and I wanted to get back into that. This allowed me to do it.
So is this more of a domestic thriller in some ways, or
yeah,
procedural?
Oh, no, certainly not procedural, but it is the stakes are small. The stakes are Jenkins County, West Virginia, and the people who are close to Irene. As the secrets are uncovered, her family is put into danger, and that's a bad line to cross for Irene, because she was not only Irene's background. Not only was she the director of the FBI and a field agent, she was on the hostage rescue team back when she was a field agent. So she's got
skills.
But she's also got age, and I actually don't know how old she is, because I don't age my characters. But it was like writing with a different corner of my mind, and I really enjoyed that.
So you feel like that's a way to stoke your creativity a little bit?
I think so. You know, writing, creativity is a flow, I think. It's a process. And right now I'm in a cycle where I do an Irene book and then a Jonathan Grave book. So kind of the same worlds, except they can't talk to each other because of the way things fell apart. So yeah, it's her thrillers are softer, I guess, than the Grave books. But the stakes are very, very high because it's her family, and it's always about justice and right and wrong. And, isn't it easier? One of the plot elements in Burn Bridges is the autopsy on this body that was found on her property is altered to be something that it's not. So, and it happened a long time ago. It happened, you know, decades ago, the murder did. So on one hand, the smart move is to, in your new community, you want to stay invisible. The smart move is to just let it go. Who cares? It's not, you know, you can bring them back to life, right? But right is right and wrong is wrong. And Irene Rivers was the last honest person in Washington in the Grave series before she was kicked out.
And don't you think sticking to the truth in a character is so essential for your books? Like, what would this character do? This character would never walk away from a murder, right?
Right. She couldn't sleep. And I couldn't sleep. You know, it's weird. Well, you know this. Writing is part psychosis because you actually talk to your imaginary friends and they answer.
Well, when you're in a book, you're in the middle of the manuscript, how much are you thinking like that character when you're not sitting at your keyboard?
Actually, not a lot. I'm one of those that I don't have an outline. I sit down, kind of get in the moment, and then have a psychic break, and I write what I see in the story and progress the story, and that's a cool idea, and then move on from there. But when the workday is over, for me, the workday is over.
Do you hit that moment of flow that writers are always seeking?
You know, it's not often enough, but when it happens, it happens. I hear from my family, they can tell by how hard I'm pounding the keyboard. I never actually learned to type. I don't use all my fingers, but I learned on a manual typewriter. And when I'm really in the moment, I'm breaking my desk. I'm pounding away, and the world knows to stay away from me.
Do you miss the sound of the keyboard?
I do. And you know what? That you can actually get an app that will make that sound. But if you don't have the little zing thing to take it back. But yes, I do. The tap, tap, tap of computer keys is just not as engaging as the clack, clack, clack.
Before I forget, I do have a real keyboard that plugs into the computer and is wired or wireless.
Yeah.
It's a real keyboard where you're really hitting the keys. It's fantastic.
Really?
Yes. Okay. I'll share that with you. Okay. So when you're switching like subgenre of thriller, do you feel like you can bring your audience around, or are there different reader expectations when you're looking at smaller stakes and maybe somewhat domestic thriller?
The book came out last week. Ask me in 3 months.
Does that worry you, or did you talk to your publisher about that?
Yeah, I think my fans are very loyal. There are the non-Grave books, and I've done another series of Victoria Emerson trilogy. It was kind of post-apocalyptic. The sales were good, but they don't touch what the Grave books were. And this is the first time I've done spin-out on that particular series, so we'll see. I mean, the first week sales numbers are very encouraging, but those are first week sales are the ones that are pre-ordered and have been, you know, sort of waiting to be released. So we'll know in a couple of months, but I hope so.
But they're both thrillers, right? It's not like you really jumped into something completely. This isn't like romanticy.
No.
Are you going to write some romanticy, John?
Yeah,
is that not your the bucket
that's,
list?
That's me, and that comes with a divorce attorney.
So I want to ask you the one question all writers hate is like, where do you get your ideas, right? Because people ask that all the time, right? But what I'm interested in is how the idea changes. Like in this particular case, in the burn bridges, do you remember the spark of it? And how, as you were writing, since you're not an outliner, how did it develop and change? Like did the initial thrust, the idea, the feelings you had at the beginning, did that kind of stay intact?
This is a great time to ask this question because it actually affects this book. I can literally define the moment when the idea came to me, and that was when my dog went and tried to get into that cave. I thought, okay, so what happens if they pull up and it's a body? No, it's a fragment of a shirt because you don't want to reveal it too soon. Well, somebody stuffed a body in a cave a while ago, in this case, decades ago. What are they hiding? Who's hiding it? What are they willing to do to protect that secret? Because there's no statute of limitations on murder. Is it a murder? So, which gets us back to the faked autopsy. And what Irene saw on her property as they're pulling out the body is different than what she read in the final report. So it's literally, it's the what if, and then what? And it's a thriller, so you got to have a thrilling sequence. And what's that going to be? Who's pushing back? Why are they pushing back? The people who are pushing back, this thing happened decades ago. So who are they? They're not, even if they're murderers, they're not perceived as such. So are they scions of the community? Or are they pillars of the community? Okay. What are you willing to do to protect that?
When you have like, oh, that's great. Are you putting questions on all these different levels in the reader's mind? So as you're doing that and you're sort of following the story in your head, are you making lists of potential outcomes or what is actually the process for looking at where is this plot going to go? Like, how do you do that?
I am playing the childhood game of let's say that, you know, oh, let's say that this happens. And then a couple of pages in, maybe, okay, that was a bad idea and come back. But it's really this voyage of discovery, of exciting discovery. What's the really coolest thing, the worst thing that can happen to a character at this moment, or the best thing that can happen to this character in the moment? And what are the other pressures? You know, Irene is not, she's no longer just the FBI director. She's a parent again. And she's moved her teenage kids from Washington, D.C. to West Virginia, to the middle of nowhere. So she's got a teenage girl who is not all that thrilled about being in the middle of nowhere. So while all of this stuff is going on, you've got to deal with teenage angst that she never really had to deal with directly before. And so it's just the complexities of characters I found really exciting. And it's a different itch than I've scratched in a long time. It was very exciting.
I can hear the excitement in your voice. Yes. And by the way, that's a really good sign for the reader, the fact that you're excited about it. Now, how hard is it to write characters of different ages like that? Like, do you just rely on your personal experience with you being that age and other people you know, or do you have to go back and research? Or do you have to worry about like a kid today at that age? Because they're different, right, in the way they think?
I have to be careful here because the today's teenagers are so much different and have so much different pressures than teenagers of my age, of my time. In this case, Kelly, her 17-year-old, has a cyberbullying incident against her that is devastating. I mean, just horrible. And she's the new kid in a school where kids have been going together since first grade. You know, they all know each other. And she's not only the outsider, she's the outsider who's Irene Rivers' child and half the country hates. And so she's trying to deal with all of that stuff at the same time. What I do is I put myself there and think, what do you do? What does that panic look like or feel like? The big question is, whose point of view do you tell that from? And because I've never been a teenage girl, I tend to write the angsty scenes from the point of view of her cousin, Wyatt, the adopted cousin, who's sort of world-weary in his own way, but he's the big observer of what's going on with the cousin he loves but hates because your kids, right? And so just go in and I pretend. I do my best.
So how do you deal with, like, dialogue? Like, for not just the age, but, like, a contemporary child of that age, And do you worry about like using slang or things that maybe will be out of use in 5 years?
I don't use a lot of dialogue. I don't do speeches. I have inner thoughts of what it is they feel and think and all of that, and then a line or two of dialogue to convey that to the other character. Mm-hmm. That's because I don't like, I'm not of the Elmore Leonard school of dialogue, 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 dialogue.
That's like 90% dialogue.
Exactly. It's just, I don't find that engaging. Sorry, Elmore. But in dealing, you want to make it real. And I also have to understand that my audience is not the 17-year-old girls that were boys or, you know, the kids that I'm representing. My audience is my generation and the adults that have the kids. Mm-hmm. So their perception is going to be different than the perception of the generation I'm referring to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're more forgiving because they don't know either.
Right. right to their ignorance. That's what I do.
that should be your tagline on your website. so when you're writing like in inner monologue, you're still writing in the voice of the character, right? Mm-hmm. Even a POV character. So how much is that? How much of that do you have to make really unique to the character? Not just what they're thinking, but how they're thinking it.
That's second draft stuff. But yes, I think I write in shifting third person. I don't write in first person. I do short stories in first person sometimes, but my books are all third person. So the scene that belongs, that is owned by the character that's on stage, even the narrative voice is their voice. Mm-hmm. Because I don't outline, the first episode is, or the first effort is just going to spill it out there. Mm-hmm. But my work day, I start every day by rewriting what I wrote the day before. Mm-hmm. So that's, you can get that kind of polish going and try to stay true. And what they would recognize, you know, it's the, going to the Jonathan Gray books, a character, he's a freelance hostage rescue specialist. So a hostage might see a gun on the floor. Jonathan's going to see a Glock 19 chambered in 9mm, mm-hmm. right? If the hostage sees a Glock 19, then we're showing something that's entirely different angle on the hostage, mm-hmm. for later in the story.
I just switched POV characters this morning, and I'm in the head of a 12-year-old neurodivergent child.
Oh, my goodness.
And I started writing, and I just stopped. I'm like, nope, that's not it. It's really hard to do that. How much on a secondary character like this does a character actually have to change from the beginning to the end of a book?
The characters have to be – I think it's important at the end that there has to be a reason that the story was told. So – happy people doing happy things happily is just not engaging. It is on Hallmark, right? We all like those on Hallmark periodically. But in a thriller, the actions have consequences. In my thrillers, actions have consequences. There are no rules. Anybody can do whatever the hell they want. But if Jonathan or Irene or whoever is going to commit risk their family's life, which is what ultimately comes down, Irene's choice comes down to, in the pursuit of justice, she can walk away and her family will be fine, or she can take the next step and endanger her family. And justice is more important than family. It's too harsh, but that's kind of where it goes. So I think for me, for my books and for books that I like, actions have to have consequences. There have to be a reason that we've lived this story today. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you have, like, do you know how many books will be in this series right now, this new series?
Well, I know it's under contract for one more.
Okay.
So
how do you handle change when it's an open-ended series? It's not a trilogy. It's not something where you can plan out with three actors and three books.
I don't, in my series, characters don't change much. It's the other stuff that changes. It's the problem that they're going to solve. That's where the change happens. Because my characters don't age. I talked about bringing down the presidential administration in zero sum. That administration had been in office since 2007, I think. So it's people don't age. Time does not advance. It's just easier with laziness on my part. So my big concern is, you know, what happens when the interest runs out? You know, 17. But I do have this commitment for John and the Graves series. I do have a commitment that if there comes a point that it's not sustaining itself anymore, it's doing really, really well. But if the publisher decides we're going to move away, I have their commitment that I get one more book. I get to end it.
Okay.
Because I know exactly how I want. I have the final scene, and it's spectacular. but I want the readers, and I want myself to have that final closure on it.
You know, speak as one of your readers. Like, I really appreciate that, because how many series, even or television shows or books that you've read, where it just sort of ended abruptly, and you're like, well, what happened?
Right.
Just that final wrap up can make the whole series so much more satisfying.
Right. Paging the Fugitive.
So you mentioned like their rules, and you can break them, do whatever you want. But like, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell said, like, five things have to go wrong in a plane for it to crash. You know, there's multiple things. Is it like that with a novelist too, where you can break a rule here and there if you know why you're doing it, but if too many of them get broken, the rules were kind of there for a reason?
I think only one wing has to fall off for a plane to crash. Is that right? No, I don't think there are any rules. In fact, the most exciting books out there are the ones that take a trope and you're absolutely, by God, sure you know where it's going to go, and then the bottom falls out, or, you know, it's entirely different. That's fun to do to a reader.
It's sort of like the Game of Thrones, right? When they kill the protagonist.
It's sense called everybody. Oh, you brought up the Game of Thrones. Here's my problem with the Game of Thrones. You never bond with anybody because everybody is so expendable. Mm-hmm. So as a viewer, I didn't read the book. I can't get through those kind of books. That's not my genre. But I was a devotee of the series. And because everybody was so expendable, I didn't care that much about them. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think you can overdo
It's a double-edged sword, right? Because also when anything can happen, it increases stakes in every scene.
Right.
You don't know the person's always going to make it through.
And, you know, what happens when you hurt a character? You know, if you've got the – I was in Fire and Rescue Service for a long time, and I teach courses about ballistics and all of this. How many times was Mannix shot in the shoulder? I don't know if that means anything different, but, you know.
It does. I'm not that young.
You know, some of these old TV shows, you get shot in the shoulder, it's no problem. You take your necktie and you just support it. After the commercial, you're good. But it's just not the way it is. It's and that level of realism is important to me. So I don't necessarily want my heroes to come out unscathed, but on the other hand, you get shot in the knee, your involvement in the story is going to be short, you know, unless that becomes the point of the story. And then what? Because next year there's going to be another book. What happens to that knee that got shot? You can't just
do you feel like readers are more sophisticated now, where you can't get away with some of that unrealistic violence?
They say that when you get an email, it's a complaint. You know, it's one email for like represents 200 people. There are thousands of people who will notice details in a book. Get a weapons detail wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exciting, isn't it? You hear from many, many people. And I'm actually good on this. I know this stuff. And when I get stuff like that wrong, it's usually a moment of inattention. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a weapon. I have one book. I easily got 50 emails from people who were complaining. I don't remember. It was one of the Grave books where Jesse Montgomery tosses his overnight bag into the back seat of his father's Corvette. Ah. Well, there are no back seats in Corvettes. If I didn't know it before, I by God know it now. Okay, so stop. Just stop. I know. So, and I can't go. Send me your book and I'll erase it if you want. But I just can't go out and change them all. But there is that space that's behind the seats, right, of a Corvette. There is a place to put an overnight bag. I called it a back seat. To this day, I don't know what I should have called it. And by God, no, I should not have called it a back seat. So is that passion? It is passion. And you know what? I always appreciate that, because if a reader is so engaged, is engaged enough in a story to write to me to tell me how I broke their a buddy of mine calls it a fictive dream, you know, that when you get in that space, I broke the story for him at that moment. And that means I didn't do my job. My job's not all that hard. There's not a lot of moving parts to it. And I drop them all.
And so outside of you've made some kind of mistake because you're moving fast. Has your editor ever caught one of those? You know, like, oh, thank God.
Copy editors will catch stuff, the little details that, you know, when did his hair color change? when did he get 5 years older?
Right.
When did it become spring? Because I thought it was summer. It was that kind of
We've
stuff.
All done that.
Yeah.
Yes.
But no, I write pretty clean copy overall. It's the, okay, the worst thing, true confessions here. In Hostage Zero, I have a Marine Corps medic. And, oh, wow, boy, howdy. that's been hundreds of emails. And I deeply apologize. Yeah, they're Navy corpsmen that are attached to Marine units. And I know that because I grew up a Navy brat, and I've been stitched up by corpsmen my whole life, or my whole youth. That was a moment of inattention. And it's insulting because of my audience and because of what people expect of my books. A moment like that, I don't think it's taken as insult. I think it's taken as startling. Maybe it's actually almost protective. Like, well, you really should change this. They're absolutely right.
Well, I think it also shows that you're getting everything else right, right? So that there was a level of trust with you, and they knew you were getting it right, and they were surprised when something was wrong.
Sure, we'll go with that.
It's a compliment, really. So speaking of that, how do you handle, like, what's the worst rejection you ever had? Or does one ever stand out, whether it was from an agent or an editor or a reader? Like, how do you handle, there's a lot of rejection in this business. How do you handle criticism?
Okay, it's two parts. The worst rejection was actually most, in retrospect, most amusing. Because, again, we're going back to 1994. And those are the self-addressed stamped envelopes. And so you'd send the query letter in an envelope with an envelope inside so that they could send your rejection back to you. You're actually paying for your own pain. and normally what you would get is this rejection letter, 95th generation Xerox copy, right, that says, "Dear John, as much as we love this book, it's just not for us." Well, my favorite rejection was they sent me back my letter, like the one I wrote with my signature on it, with a stamp, tunk, and said no. In my envelope that I paid for. But the best worst review, I actually won an award for this. What's the dinosaur poo? It's a mineral. It's actually a mineral. But anyway, I got
that's anybody clear. Dinosaur poo mineral. First time that's come up in
the something
interview.
Something-ite. So it's a something-ite. And I got the award at Crapite. Yeah. It could be. Yeah. Dino-ite. Came in a very nice engraved box from Thriller Fest, the competition. Worst review ever. The glue boogers in the binding are more captivating than Gilstrap's torpid purpose. That was for Nathan's Run, my first book.
Wow, yeah, well, that didn't do
Syracuse
very well.
Syracuse University Press, I believe.
Wow. And that book didn't reach any readership.
It includes,
it's in, what, 23 countries now or something?
Yeah, it did very well.
Yeah.
But that actually made me laugh. It was.
So I want to ask you, was it 16 bestsellers, or is it more than that now?
Numbers don't matter, do they?
Yes. And because numbers represent readership, right?
Right.
So that's wonderful. Are there certain techniques, like, say, I know a lot of people watch our podcasts are readers. Are there certain things that you found are common within your bestsellers? I mean, I know there's no formula. But, I mean, are you looking at, like, shorter chapters, or are you leading with hooks and ending with cliffhangers? Or, you know, what kind of things do you do in this that have been so successful?
I think it's telling a story with heart, with characters that feel real, where the stakes are high and the good guys win. You know, I don't I hate the notion of spending. I grew up, I'm 68 years old. So in the 70s, there was all this genre of fiction where just this bittersweet, awful ending where the world ends, right? And this is, yay, I hate that. So the good guys win in my books. That's the thing you can take away. They don't always win. Not all the good guys necessarily come out. But if a good guy dies, a good guy dies for a reason. Right? And so what makes the difference between one book and another? I have no idea. If I knew that, then, you know, that's where it is zero sum. I wouldn't share that with anybody.
don't you think that we're sort of genetically engineered for that? Like, the whole point of story was to come back and tell people how not to get eaten by the lion, right? Mm-hmm. It was those stories around the campfire. So this happy ending, don't you think that sort of leads to the why I'm telling you the story? You're living vicariously through me without a real danger, and this is how something good can come of it if this were to happen to you?
Certainly in a thriller, I think the idea is to make the audience be nervous all the time. Just yesterday, day before yesterday, Frederick Forsyth died. And I think he is the architect of the modern thriller. His Day of the Jackal, which he wrote in 35 days.
Well, it's short. Isn't that like 50,000 words or something?
And
Jackal was short, right?
I
haven't read it since the 70s, so okay. I thought it was short.
You are old.
I thought short. I am.
Okay. but there's a kinetic energy that's engineered into a thriller that pulls people in. And I think that's craft. I don't know where craft and talent, you know, go together. It's very difficult to talk about oneself using the T word. But it does come down to if it's a kinetic scene, you know, where a lot of stuff is happening, short paragraphs, lots of white space, snappy dialogue, minimal description. You know, it's that heartbeat. Because take the example of a movie. Movies have soundtracks. I used to teach at the Governor's School at the University of Richmond during the summertime. And I would take movies and put a different soundtrack to.
I love that.
Yeah, put the soundtrack from Love Story to Alexander Nevsky. You know, it changes the nature of the story. Well, we don't have the soundtrack. All we have is the syntax, the rhythm of the language, and that's the heartbeat, the da-dum, 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 that drives the story forward. Readers don't. I don't think readers understand that that's what's happening. They feel it. And if you screw it up, they don't know what you've done to screw it up. They just know it's time to go get a sandwich or, you know.
Do you feel it just intuitively as you're going through, or is this something you just had to develop over writing so many books?
I think a little bit of both. A little bit of both. I know that when I wrote my first book, the first published book, Nathan's Run, and it went fabulously successful. But to me, looking back on it now, it reads a little bit like a first book. You know, there's changes I would make. I would not make the changes because the book is what it is. But when my wife was reading the manuscript, yes, I watched her read the manuscript. But
I mean, literally.
Yeah. I mean, not like constantly, but I knew that she was in the room and it was printed out. And when she would get up to go do something, I would go and look to see where she was in the book, because they're short chapters. So if she was in the middle of a chapter and went to do something, it's a troubled chapter. It just is.
I always ask beta readers to do that. Well, where did you put the book down? Where did you stop reading? So you mentioned Frederick Forsyth's passing. The storytelling seems to be something that's sort of innate in people's compulsion. They will do it whether people are reading it or not. Do you feel like the work in some way is a legacy for you? Like there's something that's out there after you're gone, or do you not care?
There's a lot of hubris into saying that it's a legacy. It is my voice. It captures things that were important to me at the time that I wrote it. So I guess at that level, it's a legacy. People are not going to be studying my words. You know, 10 years after I stop a series is going to be gone and nobody's going to care. And that's, and I'm fine with that. It's not, it's, I've had a really good run. I'm having a really good run. I'm enjoying the run. But ultimately, it's about entertaining. It's about giving people an opportunity to escape, whatever they are. Again, those are, I'm sure you've had the letters too, from the people who are doing, you know, bedside care, you know, yeah. Or in a, they're overseas and they're at a forward operating base and they're doing, you know, whatever it is. And you get that email that says, thank you for giving, you know, giving me that moment of escape. That's it. That's it. That's the winner.
Did you always have this urge to tell stories? Do you remember the first time when you were younger, when you said, oh, this is what I want to do? Or well, let me go back. When was the first time a story actually captivated you? Do you remember? As a reader, when you were first told a story or watched a story or read a story, and you're like, oh, my God, I'm in this world, and this is an amazing thing.
Night Without End by Alistair MacLean.
One of the greats.
Yes, yes. And then that led to all of the other Alistair MacLean books. And I devoured everything. I was just a voracious reader. I know I look like an athlete, but I really never was.
So the Alistair MacLean books, right, they had these really intriguing covers of people hanging off cliffs and that kind of thing. Do you feel like, because things change, right, what's in vogue with covers, right. Everything looks the same for a while, then it all shifts again. Do you feel like that's coming back or will come back?
In cover design?
Cover design, like things that, because, you know, you look at the cover and a lot of that's, do I want to pick up this book or not? And they used to be really intriguing. And then they change, you know, the stuff in the 80s, you know, there's a lot of splashy color. Mm-hmm. And we go through all these phases.
I have learned that I don't understand cover science at all. One of the most successful books of the last 20 years had what I thought was a disastrous cover. It was Harlan Coben's Tell No One. Do you remember that? It was just red. It was just a red cover. Just red. There's nothing on it. Just red. And I thought, the hell? I only made like 10 million bucks, but, you know, it was. I just don't understand cover stuff. I think Burn Bridges' cover is one of the best ones I've had in a long time. In the early Grave books, there was a lot of, like, Washington. One of them, has crosshairs on the Capitol building or something like that. It was very inside Washington kind of stuff. Well, those are all being re-released now. And the covers are much softer, and it's less about inside Washington, less political thriller than it is a John Gilstrap book.
So do you feel like that is like the goal of the covers, to give people genre and subgenre so they can
get it before they... Anybody who says they don't buy a book by the cover is lying.
I mean, there's a reason people say that, right?
Right. I think they're lying. It's a... Who's going to... You got a lot of book covers to look at, and some are, I find, actively off-pushing. Some of them scream romance, which is great because that's their audience and that's what they're looking for. Some of them scream impenetrable literature, mm-hmm. right? Which is certainly not for me. And then some scream mystery. You got the dead body, and that's kind of a genre unto itself. And then thrillers are that I don't understand. It's, you know it when you see it, mm-hmm. and I don't know how to describe it, if that makes any sense at all.
Big stakes, danger.
Yeah, or in this case, in the I presume we'll pull up a copy of the cover for Burn Bridges. Burn Bridges has, it's kind of a gritty country look to it. You know, you're not in the big city. You're out in the boonies somewhere. But there's some element to it. I don't know if the color or whatever else, to me, really feels like a thriller as opposed to a romance or something.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
So like you say, you know, it's not in the city. How to what extent was setting in this character?
In this case, the setting is actually important because it deals with West Virginia, which is my home. I love it. It's an entirely different place. There's one medical examiner. So
for the entire state?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
So every autopsy is conducted at the state capitol, which builds in an interesting plot point because it takes a couple of days to get there, or it certainly takes a few hours to get there. And then there's one lab. So it's as opposed to around here where – every street corner has its own corner.
Well, we have one downstairs now.
Yep, and it was delicious. So in that case, the setting is important. There are fewer police, mm-hmm. on the street, which means that you probably get away with more stuff. But there are also a lot fewer people. I moved from Fairfax County when there, I think there was 1.3 million people. There's 1.7 million people in the entire state of West Virginia.
It's a gorgeous state, though.
It is a gorgeous state, but it's but everything is different, and family is important. Who is who your daddy was and who your granddaddy was is really important. That's how you will meet people. His granddaddy was so-and-so.
So did you spend a lot of time researching this? Are you talking to people, digging into the history of the state? Like, how do you get that? Because it's different. There are all these subcultures, right? And you really want that to come across in your characters.
Well, I've been blessed. Since I moved to West Virginia, I actually have a radio show. And I've interviewed all the politicians and all the, you know, the key players within the state, as well as the queen of the fair, you know, the county fair and all of that. So I've had immersion training kind of in West Virginia culture, in the, certainly Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. But then you go out into coal country where there are a lot of issues that are just waiting to be exploited. We are the number one state of opioid addiction in the nation, which is both a scourge and a business. So Irene Rivers, new place. I mean, it's different kind of political corruption is really what I write about. Those are the bad guys in my book, and cartel members, kind of the same. So it's in that sense, yes, the setting is important. But also, I hate the portrayal of the disrespectful portrayal of West Virginia as you know, a bunch of goofs. They are anything but. So my books will show respect for what, as I understand, what it's really about. And I look forward to it. This is the first salvo.
When you're writing a character like Irene Rivers, you know, you're basically dropping. It's almost like the old gunslinger in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. You're dropping someone into a town, someone who maybe just wants to be left alone, and then bad things happen. How much do you think about some of these story tropes or this long history of stories when you're building your characters?
You just hit on it, Jeff. If I write westerns, they're just not set in the West. The great books are westerns. It's the man with no name. We know his name, but oftentimes the people he's helping do not. I think that's the American story. Not the story of America, but it's a form of storytelling that is kind of distinctly American and is tied to the Westerns. Where morality, it's a code, right? There's this code. You don't cross certain lines, and if you do cross certain lines, you're in trouble. And that's still codified in the laws of West Virginia. I mean, it's so. Well, for example, the getting into, I'm a gun guy, surprising. The Castle Doctrine in West Virginia is absolute. If there is an uninvited person in your home, he is presumed to be there to cause harm. And if you use whatever force you use, that's self-defense. And you are immune from any civil litigation that might come from his family or from him if he's just hurt. It's the whole mine is mine, my property is my property. Your dog cannot cross onto my property unless it's invited. I mean, this is the stuff that kind of, I'm not saying this is my mindset, but those are the laws.
I'm guessing you don't have like a thriving DoorDash business going on.
I would say that unless you're sure of the address, if you pull up on a house and got a long driveway and the lights are off, I wouldn't go there.
So you've been doing this a long time. I'm curious, how have you seen the publishing business from the perspective of the writer change since you started?
It's changed. Bantam, Doubleday, and Dell were all different companies when I first started. So now it's BDD became, I don't even, Bertelsmann now or whatever. So it's, there were so many publishers, and now there's really only four or five before you get then to the university presses and others. So just the opportunity for a writer to find a publisher is more difficult. But I think the hunger is still there to find these folks. The parties, the Christmas parties in New York, in the mid-90s for for the publishing industry. It was ridiculous. You know, at the Leona Helmsley Hotel, whatever that one is, down by the Pan Am building, with towers of shrimp and champagne and the chocolate fountain. You know, and it was all free. It was all, you know, put on by Writer's Digest or Reader's Digest or whoever. And that's all gone. That's all gone.
So you know, you're looking at like the big five publishing houses now, and in some ways you feel like they're slower to adapt because they're so big at this point compared to like some of the, like the independent presses and some of the more the different marketing techniques and things that tend to be working. So we've seen Simon and Schuster adopt some of these more indie strategies recently.
Well, I'm with Kensington, which is the largest and last family-owned publisher in New York. They put out 600 books a year, I think. It's a big publishing house. And it's owned by Steve Zacharias. He is the CEO. He's the owner. He's the guy that writes all the checks. And so in that case, Kensington can be very fleet of foot. They can try things just because Steve says, okay, let's do this. I think when you get to the big five now, which are actually small profit centers of much larger companies, and it's often the smallest margin profit center of the company, you just can't pivot like that. It's frightening, I guess, at one level. I'm at that point in my career, and I've been blessed. I'm with a publisher that has been very supportive of me. To be entering it right now, I think it would probably be kind of scary. The days of the million-dollar advances are over, right? But I think they should be, because a million-dollar advance, right? But those who were happy at a time that we didn't have the internet. There was not – you read a book, you watch a movie in a movie theater or videotape, right? You go to Blockbuster. Or you watch television. So there was a much bigger market. I think there are a lot more readers than there are now.
I mean, because of like self-publishing, right? There's something like 3 million titles that come out a year now. But there are people, like I personally know several writers who are making, you know, six figures a year.
Yep.
They're doing okay with self-publishing. What are your thoughts on that? Because it's, you know, it was really frowned upon a long time ago, but then you see a lot of like hybrid traditional and self-published authors now.
I think if an author has an established audience and they want to shift to self-publishing, like if Kensington were to decide to drop my series, I think I have a big enough following that if I decided to self-publish, which means I got to design my own cover, I got to do like all that stuff that I just don't want to do, I could probably have a following, make a good living off of it. But if it's your first book and nobody knows who the hell you are, and frankly, you've chosen to publish your rough draft and call it a book, there's so much dreck, horrible stuff in the self-published part corners of Amazon. I don't know how they break out.
They don't.
Well, and that's a problem because some of those, amongst the piles of dreck, there are some real jewels that they don't get discovered, because they're being buried by the dreck and the I don't understand. I deeply don't understand. I've never researched it. What the Kindle self-publishing, whatever
KDP.
Yeah. Digital KDP. Okay. Mm-hmm. The one where
it's self-publishing through
right.
Amazon. Yeah.
So there's no gatekeeper. There's no quality control, and it's part of their business model. And obviously it's working for them, but I don't think it's working for the author. I think some of the best advice, I'll tell you this, it's one of the books you left out, was it's called Nick of Time. I wrote it as, they had a different title when I wrote it. And at the time, careers are, you know, sort of sine curves. And at the point where I was in my career, my agent said, you don't want to publish this right now. It's just not, it ultimately came out, but just for where I was and what was going on, this is not the book for you.
You mean in the zeitgeist? Like it just was, the public wasn't ready for it, or based on your career?
My career. At that point in my career, this wasn't the book I needed to take to the next step. So we put it in a drawer for 8 or 10 years and push it out later.
And how do you know when to trust an agent when you get that advice? Because there's so many stories about agents saying things like that, and then people say, well, I'm publishing it anyhow, and it becomes a huge, you know, runaway bestseller.
If you don't trust your agent, you have the wrong agent. And I don't have a contract with my agent. I think that's a stupid thing. I've had two agents now. I fired the first one. That's unkind, but we had a difference of opinion. Your agent is my voice. I have never once discussed any finances with my publisher. My discussions with my publisher are all creative. And if at some point, I'm sure there's been a discussion where somebody has said, there's no way Gilstrap is worth this much money, we're not going to pay him. And then the agent fights back and they do all of that. And I never know about that conversation. All I know is what comes out of that conversation with a number and, you know,
it's a beautiful thing.
The other stuff. And I say yes or no. Actually, what I say to my agent, I said, is this the best you can do? And she said, yes, it's okay. And then we go. So what an agent does is, in my case, it keeps my relationship with the publisher pure. Mm-hmm. And the editor. I don't have to discuss monetary stuff. Because, you know, that breaks relationships anytime.
Absolutely. Since we're just talking about the changing business, I have to ask you about artificial intelligence. You know, I mean, writers are mostly Luddites, and they're putting their heads in the sand here. But it's coming, and it's happening, and it's infusing every area of this. I'm sure you've seen the recent news stories that were out in the newspapers, like the list of the top books that were just generated by AI, and it hallucinated and made up fake titles. I mean, it was in two major newspapers in the U.S. How do you think AI is going to affect our writing industry?
I have no, I don't know. I don't deal in what might be. Here's the thing, and you people, writers, I'm watching there's a new Netflix series called Stick. It's by the Ted Lasso people. But anyway, they're talking. This is about golf, and the bottom line is this, and I hope the analogy makes sense, that when you're setting up a shot in golf, all that matters, it doesn't matter where that ball goes. It doesn't matter what happened with the last shot. Your entire world is right there, that point of impact. When that's done, you've lost control. What's going to happen is going to happen. As a writer, that's me. I concentrate on my bailiwick. I tell the best story that I can tell the best way I can, and then I click send, and then, you know, the editorial process and all of that. I don't say I don't care about sales, but I don't care about sales because they matter because they pay bills, but they don't matter because I can't control them. Mm-hmm. God grant me the serenity, right? So I don't worry about AI. I don't understand AI. I did actually agree to do a short story for an anthology. I thought, well, what the hell? So I said I want 5,000 word short story. I put in a number of the elements that I wanted to have, and ChatGPT or whatever it was, whatever is the one that lives on my computer. It turned out awful. It was terrible. It was just awful. So if that's what AI is generating, I'm absolutely not concerned. If AI is going to put me out of a job, yeah, I kind of reached that stage that, okay, you know, that'll be disappointing, but.
I don't know that it ever replace the human experience.
I don't think it can. I just don't think. I think robotics and AI, it's great for getting straight edges and, you know, precise cuts and whatever the hell it does. I don't see it being creative. I don't think it will do. Have you read To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yes.
Okay. AI would not come up with, and he'd be there when Jen waked up in the morning. Just wouldn't. You know, there's something so organic about that storytelling, then I think it has to come from a human. Maybe I am a Luddite. Maybe I'm the guy with the head in the sand. I don't think that you can get that level of storytelling out of a machine because it comes out from the heart of the writer.
Mm-hmm. I hope you're right.
I do too.
So there's one question that I always ask all the authors, and it sounds simple, but it really isn't. Where do you think story comes from? Is this something that's just you're putting together a twist? You've mentioned the what ifs. You see a hole in the ground, or is it coming from someplace else?
Well, I think it depends on the story. You know, there are some that were, you know, my first book, Nathan's Run. The story evolved by seeing a kid. I was named to a committee, the I don't know. It was a committee to reduce the Human Services Budget Integration Committee, I think was the name of the committee. And and I was named chair because I didn't attend the meeting, I think. And this is about cutting the human services budget within the county where I live. And I thought, well, if I'm going to cut the budgets, then I really should go visit the places. And the first place I visited was a juvenile detention center. And there was this kid. Juveniles are juveniles. It's a big range, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this one kid that was sitting in the corner. Wasn't particularly morose. He just looked lonely and scared. And that was the, what is that? What's that story? Mm-hmm. And that became Nathan's Run. What is that story? I think it evolves from my desire. That sounds so writerly, but it's my desire to play with my imaginary friends. Mm-hmm. And just to get, if you don't write it down, they just stay in your head. And by putting it down and going, okay, that's pretty good. Or at least it's out, but that really sucked. We've all done that too. You start a story and you go, no, that's not a story.
To what extent do you get comfort from the actual process of writing when you're in your head with your imaginary characters?
Oh, it's great. I think it's therapy to explore worlds and you cried when you've written a scene or laughed when you've written a scene or
oh, absolutely. If you can't feel the emotion, it's not in there.
Yeah. And to realize that, this goes back to the other thing with AI. If the writer is honest in that moment, And kind of lets the filters go, mm-hmm. which is the hard part. I think it's particularly hard for younger writers. Let the filters go and just let the story flow and the emotions flow, right? I do a lot of internal, mm-hmm. Shifting point of view kind of stuff. And you nailed it. I mean, just sometimes you go, I've ended books that way. I've had books where I think there's going to be another chapter and I realize, no, that's it.
Oh, that's great.
It's not going to get better than that.
When you're opening up like that and you're putting so much of yourself in a book, do you ever have any like trepidation before that goes out into the world? Or did you say 20 books ago?
Oh God, yes. Yeah. I came up through Todd and Robin out here from my firehouse days back in the day, where you were tough and you never. PTSD wasn't a thing. It probably was, but it wasn't. So you do bad things and see awful stuff and all that. You laugh it off and you move on. And that to reveal a soft, chewy side to a hardened group of friends, it was very well received. I don't, there's no problem with that, but it is scary. Of course it is. Because look at me, I'm vulnerable.
Oh yeah, no,
and who wants to do that?
I think it takes great courage to write anything and put it out in the public and let people sit there and criticize it or know of things about you.
Yes, which is one of the reasons, going back to an earlier thing, once it became clear that the writing thing was a smarter career choice, my wife made me make one promise, and that was that I would never write a sex scene. And I never had, because first of all, I think they stopped the story. It's like the world's on fire. We got to stop the bad guys from killing the good guys. But you know what? Let's do it. We've always got time for one more. They stopped the story. But that was her line in the sand. She said, and she just doesn't want to look at her friends and, deal with that kind of thing. And I think that's entirely fair.
Oh, I love that. All right, I'm going to go to some audience questions. If anybody has a question, this is a good time to ask. You have the master in front of you. I'm going to just ask you to speak into the microphone. Does anybody have a question?
So the question is, do I essentially do biographies for the characters and figure them out before? No. They evolve. They arrive because I need them to do a job for the purpose of the story. But that's never enough, right? You gotta give them some kind of a life, which usually means that there's somebody pushing back against them. So in the case of Burn Bridges, for example, that there's a scene, I think it's the first scene in the book, actually, where we've got two people there, two teenagers that are burying a teenager. They're throwing a teenager into the pit. So they're both bad dudes, but one is a worse dude than the other one. So why? You know, and how do you keep it from being cliched? What's the... that's the exploratory process. Mm-hmm. But in terms of hair color and all of that, I actually don't describe my characters. In 17 books, I have never once described Jonathan Gray. Never once. He has blue eyes. We know he has blue eyes and a good smile. That's it. There you go. You see? And that's why I don't describe him. Because the audience, the reader, is going to do, is going to describe their own attributes. It's going to be their neighbor or their favorite movie star, or whatever it's going to be. I don't want to get in the way of that.
Other questions here? Question?
One of the things that you mentioned is that you don't expect a lot of crossover between Jonathan Gray books and Perry Rivers books. And I'd like to know, is that definitive? Is that because you want Irene to shine in her own light? Or do you see five books down the road that somehow they intersect?
I don't know that I don't expect the audiences to cross over. I suspect that they won't. In a perfect world, what happens is there's a lot of people who discover Irene and say, wow, I need to read these Gray books. And there'll be people reading, you know, the Gray books, and they go the other way around. So, but you just never know. But I know that when the next Gray book comes out, it's going to be a hit because there's a lot of people waiting for those stories. Whether they will say, okay, let's try this other thing Gilstrap is doing, I don't know.
Other questions? Okay, John, where is a good place for people to find you?
JohnGilstrap.com. All things start with JohnGilstrap.com.
And you're working on the Gray book now?
Yes, putting the finishing touches on that. That'll be done next week.
Oh, that's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Now it's time to start the new Irene.
So I always ask people, if you just get a chance, rate his books on Amazon just to give them that star ratings. It always helps. And if you like what we're doing with our literary
supply. Unless you don't like it, in which case keep your silver opinion to yourself.
If you do the same for us too at Elaine's, we'd appreciate that. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. Appreciate it.